Okay, this is the audio track for Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. This is just chapter one. It's highly abridged, which means I've cut out a lot of things just so we can focus on what's important to us here. Okay, so this is chapter one, Columbus, the Indians, and Human Progress. Arawak men and women, naked, tawny, and full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the island's beaches and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore, carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, gifts. He later wrote of this in his log. They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms, and they do not know of them. For I showed them a sword, they took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. These Arawaks of the Bahama Islands were much like Indians on the mainland, who were remarkable, European observers were to say again and again, for their hospitality, their belief in sharing. These traits did not stand out in the Europe of the Renaissance, dominated as it was by the religion of popes, the government of kings, the frenzy for money that marked Western civilization, and its first messenger to the Americas, Christopher Columbus. Columbus wrote, "As soon as I arrived in the Indies, on the first island which I found, I took some of the natives by force, in order that I might learn and might give me information of whatever there is in these parts." The information that Columbus wanted most was this: where is the gold? He had persuaded the king and queen of Spain to finance an expedition to the lands. The wealth, he expected, would be on the other side of the Atlantic, the Indies and Asia, gold and spices. For like other informed people of his time, he knew the world was round, and he could sail west in order to get to the Far East. Spain was recently unified, one of the new modern nation-states like France, England, and Portugal. Its population, mostly poor peasants, worked for the nobility, who were 2% of the population and owned 95% of the land. Spain had tied itself to the Catholic Church, expelled all the Jews, driven out the Moors. Like other states of the modern world, Spain sought gold, which was becoming the new mark of wealth, more useful than land because it could buy anything. There was gold in Asia, it was thought, and certainly silk and spices, for Marco Polo and others had brought back marvelous things from their overland expeditions centuries before. Now that the Turks had conquered Constantinople in the eastern Mediterranean and controlled the land routes to Asia, a sea route was needed. Portuguese sailors were working their way around the southern tip of Africa. Spain decided to gamble on a long sail across an unknown sea. In return for bringing back gold and spices, they promised Columbus 10% of the profits, governorship over newfound lands, and the fame that would go with a new title, Admiral of the Ocean Sea. He was a merchant's clerk from the Italian city of Genoa, a part-time weaver, son of a skilled weaver, and an expert sailor. He set out with 3 sailing ships, the largest of which was the Santa Maria, perhaps 100 feet long, and 39 crew members. Columbus would never make it to Asia, which was thousands of miles further than he had calculated, imagining a smaller world. He would have been doomed by that great expanse of sea, but he was lucky. 1/4 of the way there, he came upon an unknown, uncharted land that lay between Europe and Asia, the Americas. It was early October 1492, and 33 days since he and his crew had left the Canary Islands off the Atlantic coast of Africa. Now they saw branches and sticks floating in the water. They saw flocks of birds. These were signs of land. Then, on October 12th, a sailor called Rodrigo saw the early morning moon shining on white sands, and he cried out. It was an island in the Bahamas, the Caribbean Sea. The first man to sight land was supposed to get a yearly pension of 10,000 maravedis for life, but Rodrigo never got it. Columbus claimed that he had seen a light the evening before, and so he got the reward. So, approaching land, they were met by the Arawak Indians, who swam out to greet them. The Arawaks lived in village communes, had a developed agriculture of corn, yams, cassava. They could spin and weave, but they had no horses or work animals. They had no iron, but they wore tiny gold ornaments in their ears. And this was to have enormous consequences. It led Columbus to take some of them aboard his ship as prisoners, because he insisted that they guide him to the source of the gold. He then sailed to what is now Cuba, then to Hispaniola, the island which today consists of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And there, bits of visible gold of the rivers and a gold mask presented to Columbus by a local Indian chief led to wild visions of gold fields. On Hispaniola, out of the timbers of the Santa Maria, which had run aground, Columbus built a fort, the first European military base in the Western Hemisphere. He called it Navidad, Christmas, and left 39 crew members there with instructions to find and store the gold. He took more Indians prisoners and put them aboard his two remaining ships. At one part of the island, he got into a fight with Indians who refused to trade as many bows and arrows as he and his men wanted. Two were run through with swords and bled to death. Then the Nina and the Pinta sent sail for the Azores and Spain. When the weather turned cold, the Indian prisoners began to die. Columbus's report to the court of Madrid was extravagant. He insisted he had reached Asia, it was Cuba, and an island off the coast of China, Hispaniola. His descriptions were part fact, part fiction. Hispaniola is a miracle. Mountains and hills, plains and pastures are both fertile and beautiful. The harbors are unbelievably good, and there are many wide rivers, of which the majority contain gold. There are many spices, and a great mines of gold and other metals. The Indians, Columbus reported, are so naive and so free with their possessions that no one who has not witnessed them would believe it. When you ask for something they have, they never say no. To the contrary, they offer to share with anyone. He concluded his report by asking for a little help from their majesties, and in return he would bring them from his next voyage as much gold as they need and as many slaves as they ask. He was full of religious talk. Thus the eternal God, our Lord, gives victory to those who follow his way over apparent impossibilities. Because of Columbus's exaggerated report and promises, his second expedition was given 17 ships and more than 1,200 men. The aim was clear: slaves and gold. They went from island to island in the Caribbean, taking Indians as captives. But as word spread of the Europeans' intent, they found more and more empty villages. On Haiti, they found that the sailors left behind in Fort Navidad had been killed in a battle with the Indians, after they had roamed the island in gangs looking for gold, taking women and children as slaves for sex and labor. Now, from his base on Haiti, Columbus sent expedition after expedition into the interior. They found no gold fields, but had to fill up the ships returning to Spain with some kind of dividend. In the year 1495, they went on a great slave raid, rounded up 1,500 Arawak men, women, and children, put them in pens guarded by Spaniards and dogs, then picked the 500 best specimens to load onto ships. Of those 500, 200 died en route. The rest arrived in Spain and were put up for sale by the archdeacon of the town, who reported that, although the slaves were naked as the day they were born, they showed no more embarrassment than animals. Columbus later wrote, "Let us in the name of the Holy Trinity go on sending all the slaves that can be sold." But too many of the slaves died in captivity. And so Columbus, desperate to pay back dividends on those who had invested, had to make good on his promise to fill the ships with gold. In the province of Sicao in Haiti, he and his men imagined huge gold fields to exist. They ordered all persons 14 years or older to collect a certain quantity of gold every 3 months. When they brought it, they were given copper tokens to hang around their necks. Indians found without a copper token had their hands cut off, and they bled to death. The Indians had been given an impossible task. The only gold around were bits of dust garnered from the streams, so they fled. They were hunted down with dogs and were killed. Trying to put together an army of resistance, the Arawaks faced Spaniards who had armor, muskets, swords, horses. When the Spaniards took prisoners, they hanged them or burned them to death. Among the Arawaks, mass suicide began with cassava poison. Infants were killed to save them from the Spaniards. In 2 years, through murder, mutilation, or suicide, half of the 250,000 Indians on Haiti were dead. When it became clear that there was no gold left, the Indians were taken as slave labor on huge estates known later as encomiendas. They were worked at a ferocious pace, and they died by the thousands. By the year 1515, there were perhaps 50,000 Indians left. By 1550, there were 500. A report of the year 1650 shows none of the original Arawaks or their descendants left on the island. The chief source, and on many matters the only source of information about what happened on the islands after Columbus came, is Bartolomé de las Casas, who as a young priest participated in the conquest of Cuba. For a time he owned a plantation on which Indian slaves work, but he gave that up and became a vehement critic of Spanish cruelty. Las Casas transcribed Columbus's journal and, in his 50s, began a multi-volume history of the Indies. In it, he describes the Indians. They are agile, he said, and can swim long distances, especially the women. They are not completely peaceful because they do battle from time to time with other tribes, but their casualties seem small. And they fight when they are individually moved to do so because of some grievance, not on the orders of captains or kings. Women in Indian society were treated so well as to startle the Spaniards. Las Casas describes sex relations. Marriage laws are non-existent. Men and women alike choose their mates and leave them as they please, without offense, jealousy, or anger. They multiply in great abundance. Pregnant women work to the last minute and give birth almost painlessly, up the next day. They bathe in the river and they are clean as healthy as before giving birth. If they tire of their men, they give themselves abortions with herbs that force stillbirths, covering their shameful parts with leaves or cotton cloth. Although on the whole, Indian men and women look upon total nakedness with as much casualness as we look upon a man's head or his hands. The Indians, Las Casas said, have no religion, at least no temples. They live in large communal bell-shaped buildings, housing up to 600 people at one time, made of very strong wood and roofed with palm leaves. They prize bird feathers of various colors, beads made of fish bones and green and white stones, with which they adorn their ears and their lips. But they put no value on gold and other precious things. They lack all manner of commerce, neither buying nor selling, and rely exclusively on their natural environment for maintenance. They are extremely generous with their possessions, and by the same token covet the possessions of their friends and expect the same degree of liberality. In Book 2 of his History of the Indies, Las Casas, who at first urged replacing Indians by black slaves, thinking they were stronger and would survive, but later relented when he saw the effects on blacks, tells about the treatments of the Indians by the Spaniards. It is a unique account and deserves to be quoted at length. Endless testimonies prove the mild and pacific temperament of the natives, but our work was to exasperate, ravage, kill, mangle, and destroy. Small wonder, then, if they tried to kill one of us now and then. The admiral, it is true, is blind as those who came after him, and he was so anxious to please the king that he committed irreparable crimes against the Indians. Las Casas tells how the Spaniards grew more conceited every day, and after a while refused to walk any distance. They rode the backs of Indians if they were in a hurry, or were carried on hammocks by Indians running on relays. In this case, they also had Indians carry large leaves to shade them from the sun, and others to fan them with goose wings. Total control led to total cruelty. The Spaniards thought nothing of knifing Indians by tens and twenties, and of cutting slices off them to test the sharpness of their blades. Las Casas tells how two of these so-called Christians met two Indian boys one day, each carrying a parrot. They took the parrot and, for fun, beheaded the boys. The Indians' attempts to defend themselves failed, and when they ran off into the hills, they were found and killed. So Las Casas reports, they suffered and died in the mines and in other labors in desperate silence, knowing not a soul in the world to whom they could turn for help. He describes their work in the mines. Mountains are stripped from top to bottom and bottom to top 1,000 times. They dig, split rocks, move stones, and carry dirt on their backs to wash it in the rivers. While those who wash gold stay in the water all the time with their backs bent so constantly it breaks them. And when water invades the mine, the most arduous task of all is to dry the mines by scooping up pans full of water and throwing it up outside. After each 6 or 8 months' work at a time, which was the time required of each crew to dig enough gold for melting, up to 1/3 of the men died. While the men were sent many miles away to the mines, the wives remained to work the soil, forced into the excruciating job of digging and making thousands of hills for cassava plants. Thus, husbands and wives were together only once every 8 or 10 months, and when they met, they were so exhausted and depressed on both sides they ceased to procreate. As for the newly born, they died early because their mothers, overworked and famished, had no milk to nurse them. And for this reason, while I was in Cuba, 7,000 children died in 3 months. Some mothers even drowned their babies from sheer desperation. In this way, husbands died in the mines, wives died at work, and children died from lack of milk. And in a short time, this land, which was so great, so powerful and fertile, was depopulated. My eyes have seen acts so foreign to human nature, and I now tremble as I write. When he arrived on Hispaniola in 1508, Lacasas said that there were 60,000 people living on this island, including the Indians. So that from 1494 to 1508, over 3 million people had perished from war, slavery, and the mines. Who in future generations will believe this? I myself writing it, as knowledgeable eyewitness, can hardly believe it. Thus began the history, 500 years ago, of the European invasion of the Indian settlements of the Americas. That beginning, when you read Las Casas, even if his figures are exaggerations, were there 3 million Indians living there to begin with, as he says, or less than 1 million, as some historians have calculated, or 8 million, as other historians now believe. That history is conquest, slavery, death. When we read the history books given to children in the United States, it all starts with a heroic adventure. There is no bloodshed. And Columbus Day is a celebration. Past the elementary and high schools, there are only occasional hints of something else. Samuel Eliot Morison, the Harvard historian, was the most distinguished writer on Columbus, the author of a multi-volume biography, and was himself a sailor who retraced Columbus's route across the Atlantic. In his popular book, Christopher Columbus, Mariner, written in 1954, he tells about the enslavement and the killing. The cruel policy initiated by Columbus and pursued by his successors resulted in complete genocide. That is on one page, buried halfway into the telling of a grand romance. In the book's last paragraph, Morison sums up his views on Columbus. He had his faults and his defects, but they were largely the defects of the qualities that made him great. His indomitable will, his superb faith in God, and his own mission as the Christ-bearer to lands beyond the seas. His stubborn persistence despite neglect, poverty, and discouragement. But there was no flaw, no dark side, to the most outstanding and essential of all of his qualities, his seamanship. One can lie outright about the past. One can omit facts which might lead to unacceptable conclusions. Morison does neither. He refuses to lie about Columbus. He does not omit the story of mass murder. Indeed, he describes it with the harshest word one can use, genocide. But he does something else. He mentions the truth quickly and goes on to other things more important to him. Outright lying or quiet omission takes the risk of discovery, which, when made, might arouse the reader to rebel against the writer. To state the facts, however, and then to bury them in a mass of other information, is to say to the reader with a certain infectious calm, Yes, mass murder took place, but it's not that important. It should weigh very little in our final judgments. It should affect very little of what we do in the world. To emphasize the heroism of Columbus and his successors as navigators and discoverers, and to de-emphasize their genocide, is an ideological choice. It serves unwittingly to justify what was done. My point is not that we must, in telling history, accuse, judge, condemn Columbus in absentia. It is too late for that. It would be a useless scholarly exercise in morality. But the easy acceptance of atrocities as a deplorable but necessary price for progress, Hiroshima and Vietnam to save Western civilization, Kronstadt and Hungary to save socialism, nuclear proliferation to save us all, that is still with us. One reason these atrocities are still with us is that we have learned to bury them in a mass of other facts, as radioactive wastes are buried in containers in the earth. We have learned to give them the exact same proportion of attention that teachers and writers often give them in the most respectable of classrooms and textbooks. This learned sense of moral proportion, coming from the apparent objectivity of the scholar, is accepted more easily than when it comes from politicians at press conferences. It is therefore more deadly. All right, and that's the end. Thanks for listening.